Thank you very much, Art. Today I would like to take the opportunity to discuss with you some of the exciting major current and foreseeable technological advances in the telecommunications industry, to discuss for a moment the strong interactions that these advances have with social and economic considerations, the extent to which social and economic considerations play a large part in either stimulating or retarding the rate at which technology is introduced and assimilated, and to describe some of the challenges to public policy which are now being posed by technological opportunities now before us. There has been much talk in recent years about the great revolution in telecommunications. Over the years, technological progress has been very rapid. Many writers have emphasized the revolutionary impact that new applications will have on our daily lives. The home console that can bring in all kinds of information flows which today are not feasible. The stock market, shopping services, banking, computer links, facsimile mail, and so forth. And while this promise is indeed great in many areas, as I would like to sketch briefly today, it is important to remember that technological advance has already had a revolutionary impact on our society. Certainly, the telephone, which was not invented just yesterday, has enjoyed very large technological advances, which have permitted rate reductions in the face of strong general inflation, introduction of new kinds of services that were simply not visualized, say, back in the 1920s. While the introduction of new telecommunications services and new technology have together been striking, perhaps most spectacular are the examples to be drawn from long-distance transmission technology. These are the ones which have attracted so much of the attention in recent years, particularly communication satellites. In comparison with the earlier open wire circuitry, the employment of microwave and coaxial cable has had a dramatic effect on circuit cost and quality. To take just a couple of examples, today a good deal of investment in long-distance transmission is going into coaxial cable. An earlier cable, so-called L1 cable, had a capacity of a couple of thousand voice channels, and it involved an annual cost of about $3 per voice channel. Its successor, the L3, had something like eight times the capacity, 16,000 voice channels, and the circuit cost dropped to about $1.50. Today, we are seeing the installation of the L4, which has over 32,000 voice circuits, at something in the neighborhood of 90 cents per voice channel, a drop of more than threefold in comparison with the L1. And in the early and mid-70s, we foresee the installation of the so-called L5, which will have 81,000 voice circuits, a couple of times more than the L4, at a circuit cost of maybe 35 cents. So we see an order of magnitude change in the circuit cost from the L1 to the 5. Of course, in the field of satellite development, we have seen very rapid progress. The first commercial satellite, the Early Bird, was launched in April 65 with 240 voice circuit capacity. But in December of 68, just a few months ago, the Intelsat 3 was launched with 1,000. This is roughly a fourfold increase. And in a couple of years, we'll have the Intelsat 4, which will have yet five times more capacity. And these are systems which do not vary a good deal in total cost, but whose capacities are so much larger that the per-circuit cost turns out to be very low. Well, the impact of these advances is by now well known. Transatlantic television service via satellite is routine. We talked about this in theoretical terms back in the early 60s, that this might eventually be quite feasible with satellites, which at that time were only imperfectly envisaged. But today we see this as quite routine. Radio telephone service, which is subject to atmospheric vagaries and low capacity, is being phased out in favor of satellites and in favor of new transistorized transoceanic cable. One thing that immediately comes to mind, many observers have said that by this time, transmission cost is so low relative to other components of the modern telephone plant that, you know, is this really going to make much difference anymore? You know, if a 2,000-mile circuit costs 35 cents or costs $10, this may have little effect because let's look at the national telephone plant, and we find in this that only 17% is really comprised of long-distance transmission facilities, while 45% would be tied up in switching, 23% in terminal, and 15% in the local loops. So with this very small portion in the total plant, why should we be so concerned about the growth of satellites, the growth of new kinds of coaxial? Haven't we just about reached the limit in terms of the economic impact? And the answer here, and something that should be carefully emphasized, is no, these advances can have a very substantial impact. Because we find that the major reason why most of the telephone plant is tied up in what we would call the local facilities is simply a reflection of the fact that most business is local. That is, the large, by far the largest number of calls placed to the telephone system today are local. And therefore, with the switching requirements, with the local loop requirements, this necessarily, then together, comprises the major part of total cost. But let us look at the kinds of impacts that the new technology in long-distance transmission might have. It is not at all difficult to visualize, with these very low circuit costs that I have mentioned to you, a national flat rate service, where a call from the New York Hilton down to Wall Street would involve no smaller cost than a call from the New York Hilton to Los Angeles. Because that long-distance circuit will indeed be such a small part of total cost that simply the billing function, the accounting function, is something which can be avoided with direct distance dialing. Let us say by 1980, I think it's quite reasonable to suppose a nationwide system where, for a fixed fee, one can call any place. And one can imagine the revolutionary benefits that this could have in medical applications, which have already been touched on, in computer links, real-time computer uses on a regional and national basis, many other uses where today the long-distance cost really is an impediment. And where today, let us take the case of television, where long-distance interconnection, especially for educational television, is a substantial impediment. There is one other point I would like to emphasize in comparing technologies. We can talk about a particular system which involves a particular cost which seems much lower than some earlier technology. This has been particularly the case in the use of satellites for domestic purposes, especially for television distribution. By now, we have seen many studies. These are studies over the past few years which have attempted to compare the costs of satellites with terrestrial communications techniques. And frequently, these studies will show that satellites are substantially less expensive for a given circuit capacity. And for some applications, this may well be true. There is one note of warning which is important to emphasize among those engaged in systems studies, and that is that it is important to discuss, to compare the costs of a new technology with what we call the incremental costs of the old. That is, if you have an existing microwave system in operation, and there is now an alternative of placing a satellite in operation that will do the same job, then one must compare the total cost of the satellite system with the incremental cost, the additional cost of supplying the microwave system with enough additional capacity to do the same job. Now, this seems like a fairly straightforward point, and yet it's amazing how much difficulty one encounters in trying to make this operational. If one attempts to look at a nationwide satellite system, one then has to view as an alternative the already very large existing telecommunications system, which consists of microwave, of coaxial, of some open wire, plus a lot of switching equipment, some of which would be also used by the satellite, some of which would not. And it is really amazing the difficulty one has in undertaking a systems analysis to determine how the satellite compares when one takes into account the relevant costs. And in this case, it is the cost, the additional cost to the terrestrial system of expanding capacity to do that same job. And on the task force on communications policy, where we were concerned with this issue, as well as studies we have done at RAND, this has been and continues to be one of the most serious problems. One of the most troublesome aspects of this is the tendency to compare the costs of a satellite system simply with the existing tariffs of a communications company for comparable kinds of service. And it is quite clear that these tariffs certainly do not reflect the underlying incremental costs, and therefore supply us with an inaccurate, misleading judgment for comparison. And so one of the important challenges to systems analysis in this particular area, and this is just one of many examples, is to dig down and look at those incremental costs. Well, with this, with these new technological advances, with the many kinds of uses which people now visualize, the expanded use of television for educational, cultural purposes, the expanded use of simply telephone, especially if we have a flat rate system, the use of telecommunications to supply greater numbers of computer links for banking, shopping, medical purposes, a national library, international information flows. These are all very exciting. And in terms of straightforward economics, the costs in many cases look quite attractive. And one can visualize, just if one undertakes a standard systems analysis, that there should be no great problem in introducing many of these services over the next decade. But here we come to the question of public policy and the extent to which the impact of technology on social and economic factors is such that impediments may arise to the growth of new technology, to the growth of new applications, or where it is at least very important that we have a well-conceived public policy towards the industry in order to facilitate and to promote the growth of new technology. It is quite clear that much will depend on how the system, on how various aspects, parts of the system are owned, operated, and regulated in determining the extent to which the new technology will actually be employed. Especially important are the ground rules by which prices to the user are set. And this is a sticky problem because these prices take into account costs which are jointly generated with other services. Take, for example, in long-distance service, the telephone instrument itself is used for the long-distance service as well as for local service. And the question arises, well, how does one apportion the cost of that instrument between long distance and local? And the answer to that question has a very crucial bearing then on what tariffs are charged for what particular services, and therefore how attractive that service will be. This is a terribly important area when we look at computer applications. If we're really serious about national medical libraries, which would be tied with telecommunications links to outlying areas, then we are concerned about how the use of jointly operated facilities are allocated in cost among the computer services, among conventional telephone users, and others. And these rules are necessarily partly a reflection of arbitrary judgments about which particular groups of users should pay which particular portion of the total cost. One of the striking things we found in looking at technological advance is that the purely technical problems are frequently amenable to the fairly straightforward solutions, not always, but frequently. It is that much more difficult when we come to the social and economic problems, such things as this apportionment of cost, such things as determining what would be a well-conceived public policy to guide, to facilitate the growth of the new technology. And in closing, I would like to just mention briefly a few concrete examples where social and economic considerations impinge upon the choices of technology. If we're interested in low-cost satellite services, for example, very much depends on how satellite services are owned, how they're priced. If we have a satellite domestically, should we permit television broadcasters to deal directly with a satellite entity? Should these broadcasters have their own ground stations? Or should they purchase through the existing common carriers, the entities which today supply television service through the microwave network? Should the satellite system itself be owned by television interests? Or indeed, is demand for satellite service in the foreseeable future large enough that one can visualize several satellite systems? One perhaps dedicated to television use, another perhaps to telephone, to the more standard narrowband uses, perhaps a third to serve a particular large companies, which rather than purchasing private line circuits through existing common carriers might find it economic to have their own dedicated facilities. Well, these answers are not well known. Much depends on further analysis and on further experimentation to determine more precisely what the needs are for telecommunications and more precisely what the costs would be. One aspect, which is a very much concern today before the FCC, a more general concern than that dealing just with satellites, is simply the degree to which competition should be introduced in the telecommunications business. Would it be advisable, for example, if certain computer users, let's say some of them in the Midwest, some of them in the East, would want to get together and set up their own dedicated microwave system to serve their uses? Or indeed for new specialized common carriers to be established to supply new kinds of service to particular business groups using facilities which are today or would not be a part of the regular common carrier network. Well, obviously, the answers to these kinds of questions will have a lot to do with the way particular companies develop through time, with the way that new entrepreneurs may be allowed to come into the market, and ultimately, of course, with the benefits that society will derive. These are the kinds of questions which the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is today very much concerned with. The answers are not clear, but it is this kind of aspect of public policy which needs to be looked at, and especially by technical people working together with economists, with social scientists, with legal experts. There are a couple of other things that I might mention in passing, other examples of public policy problems. We've heard a good deal about the shortage of radio spectrum. I've not yet mentioned this. There will be a session this afternoon that will deal more specifically with this area. But the question of to the extent to which new communications technology will affect the use of spectrum, the extent to which a new technology may be inhibited because it would interfere in the use of spectrum with other technologies. The best example of this is, again, the satellite, where there has been much concern about the potential interference between a satellite system used for domestic purposes and the extensive domestic terrestrial microwave system. And again, we don't have good answers to this level of interference because a good deal of experimentation is required. But I feel confident that with the many trade-offs that exist in satellite design and in other equipment design, that there can be, with the radio spectrum, an enormous increase in telecommunications capacity involving satellites, involving microwave, involving other applications, going far beyond what we can now visualize. But again, what this will take is a sensible public policy, a sensible management technique with respect to use of the radio spectrum. It is my personal opinion that today we use spectrum space in a very wasteful fashion, and that relatively crude reforms would be sufficient to provide a vast expansion in the extent to which we can make use of the radio spectrum to serve the needs of man. Finally, I might close by mentioning very briefly the recent growth of cable television. This is an industry which is now bringing into the home many more channels of television which then can be supplied over the air. And this has given rise to much excitement about the possibilities for cable television in the future. The possibility of bringing 15, 20, or 30 channels into the home, channels which can be used for a broad range of cultural, educational, and entertainment purposes, going far beyond anything that we can visualize with the conventional over-the-air systems. And here again, we get into the questions of public policy, into the questions of economics and sociology as they interact with the purely technical aspects. Because we can undertake the technical analysis now and say that for a few dollars a month, it is technically feasible to bring in 20 channels into the home. But immediately the question arises, what will we use this capacity for? How can you possibly fill 20 channels? There are those who say that there's a limitation of talent, that there's just not enough talent. There's not enough money for programming to supply that number of hours that would fill 20 or 30 channels. But here we get into the economic and sociological aspects. There are today literally thousands, millions of feet of videotape of programs which have been presented before, cultural programs, specials, which are shown once a year, and the videotapes then sit in the libraries of the networks, and they're never seen again. Now, one can immediately visualize with a cable system a lot of repeat performances, where the Sunday afternoon cultural and educational programs are also shown on primetime during the week on a repeat basis, much as we see in the movie industry. Where if you cannot see the Meet the Press on Sunday afternoon, you may also see it at 9 o'clock on Tuesday evening, if that's more convenient. Well, it's quite obvious that this kind of an arrangement would very much require an alteration in marketing arrangements in the television industry. The way the whole system operates, the economics of it, which would then have a good deal to do with the social impact. Well, I've attempted to give you here just a few examples, trying to be as concrete as possible about some of these advances, some of the possible benefits, but some of the problems in terms of public policy, which we will have to face, which we're facing now and will face in the future, in an attempt to most wisely exploit these very exciting opportunities before us. And so, in closing, I can only echo the remarks of Dr. Seifert, who emphasized the need for more systems analysis, the importance of bringing together groups of people, interdisciplinary groups, that can look at the applications of new technology in more than just the narrow sense. In the case of cable television, groups that can say not only that it costs X dollars to supply a cable to a particular home or to a particular city, but can describe the social impact, the economic problems, the institutional problems that must be faced in actually exploiting that kind of technology. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Our final speaker this morning will be Dr. Manfred Altman. Dr. Altman received his B.S. in Chemical Engineering from the Newark College of Engineering and his M.S. and D.S.C. from NYU. He's currently the Director of Science and Technology Division of the Center for Urban Research and Experimentation at the University of Pennsylvania and concurrently the Director of the Institute for Direct Energy Conversion at the university. Previously, he was with the General Electric Company at the Hanford Knowles Atomic Power Plant and then with the Missile Division. Dr. Altman is the author of The Current Foundations of Solid-State Energy Conversion and numerous other publications. He's a past member of the Presidential Panel on Energy Sources, the Commerce Department Panel on Electric Vehicles, and the Pennsylvania State Transportation Committee, and he is presently editor-in-chief of the Energy Conversion Journal. Dr. Altman.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm convinced that Art Bennett really did a very nice job in arranging for this meeting today and in the program he laid out, but he made one goof. He never applied the rules and methodology of systems engineering to the holding of technical sessions. And if he had, he probably would have concluded that it's bad to have a final speaker and he would have eliminated him. But he didn't do it. But I sort of take my obligation as being the final speaker seriously, and I'll try and be a little bit more humorous and try and make you feel better and prevent you from looking at me hungrily and with resentment. And just to be sure that you understand the importance of small differences, I'll tell you a little story. I tell about the parishioner who walks up to his priest one day and says, "Father," said, "do you suppose it might be all right if I smoked while I pray?" And the priest looked at him and said, "Why, that's a terrible thing to say. Of course you can't." The parishioner looks at him, "But gee whiz, McGregor talked to you yesterday and you told him it was perfectly all right." The priest takes a double take and he says, "Oh, you're all wet," he said. "He didn't ask me that question at all. What he asked me was it all right to pray while he smoked? That's different." I tell this story frequently to my students at Penn because I think that there is some value in asking questions the right way. For instance, if you ask people whether it's all right to knock their house down so that a highway can be built, I suspect that a great many of them might say no. On the other hand, suppose you were to ask them, "Do you suppose it might be all right if we put a highway through here while we renovate your house and make it real beautiful?" Somehow that is never done. If you look at the newspapers, if you look at how we go about implementing our plans, I think you'll find that there are some very severe deficiencies. But anyway, I'm a newcomer, sort of, to this business of planning and looking at the urban environment, and I thought that perhaps you might share some of my experiences with me, and I'll just review it for you and see if we have some common ground for further discussion. When I first got into this business of planning and implementing, I thought, gee, this is an engineer's dream. Can hardly do anything without making a contribution. What a wonderful thing this is. Well, now that I'm a little bit older and wiser, I've suddenly discovered that this dream turned into a nightmare. And I sort of want to explain why that has come about. As far as planning, and particularly urban planning, is concerned, believe me, a fantastic amount of work has been done. Volumes have been written. A lot has been said. You've heard a great deal today. And yet you know, and I know, that really darn little has been done. Well, when it comes to applying what we know about systems and system technology and methodology to a solution of real-world problems, let's face it, we haven't accomplished a heck of a lot. So what I would like to do today is try and examine what some of the reasons are for why this has not been more fruitful. And I figure that if we understand what the handicaps are and what the hang-ups are, maybe we can consult a psychiatrist and figure out how we can go about doing it. Let me give you a typical example of one of the biggest problems we have. I got involved in electric automobiles, and I got involved in this business of advanced power plants to keep pollution down. And I discovered something very interesting. Almost everyone who works on a new type of an engine immediately begins to look at automotive applications. Now, he does this for a very simple reason. That's where the biggest payoff is. Unfortunately, that's also where the greatest competition and the most difficulties are. And if people are astute and sensible, they'll start looking at planes, they'll look at boats, they'll get their feet wet, and they'll learn a great deal before they start attacking an automotive engine. Well, we in engineering and in science, who have developed certain tools and certain methodologies, have been just as stupid and naive. We have told the world that, by God, with these tools, we can really crack all these problems and we can really make an impact on what ails the city. And I think this was probably our first mistake, not too little and too late, but much too much and much too soon. Anyway, we ought to recognize that something even like a moonshot is at least several orders of magnitude easier than attacking the problems of a city. Let me try and define what some of the elementary differences are. When we attack a systems-type problem, the first thing that we must have is the ability to put the governing phenomena into mathematical language. Having done that, we still have to know and understand what the constraints on the system are and put those into mathematical form. Obviously, we must have well-defined and agreed-on benefit and its utility functions. We must know what the transfer and feedback functions are. Then we proceed with the building of mathematical models. Then we take these models and we test them in the laboratory and we compare predictions to actual results. Then we feed these results back into our mathematical model and see what happens. Now, having spent two rather frustrating years working with planners and people and systems on this problem, I can tell you that it's my honest and considered opinion that not one of the above requirements can be met satisfactorily when the system is a people system. I hate to say it, but honestly, it's true. Now, let's come to the second major stumbling block, which we have encountered and haven't really met successfully. Let's look at the people who are involved in planning and decision-making and implementation, and let's just look at urban technology now. Let's look at universities, first of all. There, a lot of research and training of students is going on. And we find the hard sciences, we find the soft sciences, we find the engineers, and we find that they happily live in closely confined and separated worlds. Now, what we tell them is, by God, you fellas better go out and start intermingling. Well, some students actually go and intermingle, but the faculty, God forbid. The basic problem here, of course, is that intermingling takes time, but the faculty is much too busy for that kind of nonsense. You know, it's a very simple trade-off. You can either sit down and find out more and more about less and less, as we have always recognized at universities, and publish learned papers and be promoted. But when you go out and intermingle and work with other people, how will anybody know what a great man you are? We haven't solved this problem yet, and this is why we haven't really succeeded too well. Now, let's look at the urban researcher. The urban researcher is very much like a physician. We have a physician here. He can probably verify what I'm going to say. The problem is that he's very severely limited in the kinds of experiments he can perform. I think that it's sort of essential that we understand that urbisection, like vivisection, is not acceptable in our society. The physician is concerned with prophylaxis as well as therapeutics. But the poor urban researcher is really up against it, because therapeutics is about the only way in which he can ever make a contribution. And then, of course, we have a professional planner, and it always grieves me when I interact with them. They feel threatened by what I say and what I tell them. I don't really feel antagonistic towards them. I want to help them. But you see, when you try and help somebody, he immediately assumes a defensive posture, because if you think he needs help, then obviously he isn't doing an adequate job. So the biggest problem I have in conversing and interacting with planners is the fact that they hate my guts. And if I could just figure out how to eliminate this, and I will consult a psychiatrist, I've come to a conclusion that psychiatrists are absolutely essential when it comes to doing things like that. I'll figure out some way of doing this yet. But look at this poor planner. He's in a constant state of traumatic shock. He's supposed to use the results of research. And believe me, the number of learned journals and papers is ever growing, but he finds himself in the following very sad situation. Number one, the relevancy of a published material to his immediate needs escapes him. Frankly, in 99% of the cases, it escapes me too. Two, his boss wants results in 4 years, obviously so, because he wants to be reelected. He's constantly told to be practical and not to be a visionary. And, of course, the all-too-frequent result is that even if he does come up with a plan, it's usually a long and very painful road to any kind of implementation. And I hate to tell you, frequently the implementation is wrong, too. And then, of course, we have the elected official, formerly known as a politician. His background is not technical. His characteristic time is at variance with that of future planning. A good plan and the initiation of its implementation will probably benefit his successor. But the opponents of a plan, and they're always opponents, constitute an immediate threat. Is it any wonder, then, that so little gets done? Or maybe I should rephrase it and say that maybe we ought to be astonished that anything at all is being done, which gives us hope for the future. Now, in addition to the above-mentioned problems, there are also two cardinal sins which are constantly being committed in this business of planning. And perhaps Art will be on me out on this, and if not, we can have a wonderful discussion after this is all over. The first cardinal sin which planners always commit, and there isn't a day when I don't come across this, is the constant extrapolation of current trends to predict future needs. Now, we don't have a time for me to really document my contention that this is silly, invariably leads to the wrong conclusion, but let me just give you a very simple example. Let's talk about transportation planning for a city. Well, all you have to do is look at a city like Philadelphia, and you find that we have a very beautiful central business district, almost completely surrounded by ghettos and slum districts. And if you look at this and you find out what the trends are, it's as obvious as the nose on your faces that, by God, come 1985, we're just going to be completely surrounded by slums, and if we plan a transportation system, clearly it must be the kind of a transportation system which ghetto residents will be able to and will want to use. Now, if you do that, I maintain that you are committing a cardinal sin. Because the thing to recognize is that just as the transportation planner must plan transportation, the city planner, the urban planner, must plan to get these people out of there and get them someplace where they can have jobs, where they can be happy, where they can be useful citizens. And they'll never do that by being in the wrongest possible place. I can make a very good case for the fact that nowadays the wrong people live in the city from the point of view of the fact that these city dwellers are in the least position to take advantage of what a city has to offer. So what this really boils down to is, let's stop this nonsense of extrapolating, because it isn't going to get us any place, because nobody has yet decided that the direction in which it's going is really where we ought to go. So this can't be done, and yet it is being done under the justification of, well, it's the best we know how to do. But when the best isn't good enough, well, damn it, let's admit it and get on with the real job and the real problem. Well, this, however, is really where the rub is. Namely, who is to set priorities? Who is to determine what the human values are? And who will ensure that proper goals are defined, which the engineer then can attempt to reach? Well, we've talked about the first cardinal sin. Now let's talk about the second cardinal sin. As we go about this business of planning, you will find that it's always done on the basis of a compromise. Now, most of you here are engineers, and you know that when you have an unequilibrium system which you wish to relax, what you have to do is you have to pick the weakest point and overcompensate. And this is the quickest way of arriving at a satisfactory steady-state situation. But if you try to do what our planners today have to do, namely, if you want to raise something by 40, and somebody says, no, you can't raise it by 40, you should only raise it by 20, you can see what the result will be. This is why we have expressways and transportation systems, and you name it, which are outmoded before they even are halfway through the building stage. You can't plan that way. Proportional control ought to be built in. But who are the people who are going to explain this to planners and politicians, excuse me, elected officials, who just don't have a technical background? Well, I will now, at this stage of the game, confess to you that I don't have a detailed recipe for the cure of a situation, but I do have an approach which may be helpful, and I want to tell you what it is, and hopefully we can discuss it. My recommendations would be as follows. We already have a National Academy of Science. We have a fairly new National Academy of Engineering. And I would suggest to you that what we need to do is to establish a National Academy of Human Values. This organization should come to grips with problems such as these. Why are our cities still growing, in spite of the fact that all the old justifications, such as easy defense, a ready bartering place, available public transportation, really don't apply anymore? And yet cities keep growing all the time. Before very long, 80% of us are going to live in about 2% of the available land area in the urban environment. This academy ought to address itself to questions such as these. Can one analyze cities from the point of view of a minimum energy system, a maximum communications and information system, a cultural system? What are the thermodynamic analogs to a city? Does entropy have a meaning when you talk about a city? And I would suggest to you that it does. What is an optimal population distribution as a function of a distribution of available assets in a city? If somebody would only sit down and do that, and it's an elementary exercise, you would discover very rapidly that this current trend of having poor and ghetto residents promulgate absolutely must be stopped. As a matter of fact, I just can't understand why people haven't realized this and done something about it, because something can be done about it. But anyway, this is the sort of thing our National Academy of Human Values ought to do. Second recommendation is that we need to couple this National Academy with that of science and engineering. And the desired end product should be very clear answers to such trade-offs as pollution levels versus human life, the cost of relocation of ghetto residents versus inevitable chaos, the trade-offs between a mediocre education for all or excellence for a few. Based on these answers, however, engineering solutions can undoubtedly be found. There is a third recommendation I would like to make. I think it's imperative that our national government recognizes the proper role it has to play vis-a-vis private industry. I've been involved in this interesting and fascinating game for several years now, and I have become convinced that our government just plain doesn't understand the role it has to play at this day and age. They haven't the foggiest notion of how they ought to relate to universities or to industry or to private enterprise. And I don't understand why this should be, but I think it's essential that we start there. It must learn how to translate the desiderata which are obtained from this interaction of our national academies into incentives to which private enterprise can and will respond. Let me give you an example. We know that we're in pretty sad straits as far as non-polluting power plants are concerned. I'm talking about automobiles now. I have been wrestling with this problem. I have helped the government wrestle with this problem for several years now. And it's an amazing thing that our government hasn't realized yet that if they really want to solve a problem, all they have to do is to give Detroit the incentive to do it. It turns out that the people who have the most knowledge, the most skills, and are certainly capable of producing non-polluting power plants work in Detroit. And they are not likely to come and tell you what can be done, because right now, under existing rules, it's going to cost their investors money. And by God, General Motors and Ford and everyone else is going to protect their investors. So what does the government do? The government goes and sponsors research here, a little bit of research there, and they hold conclaves and meetings, and everybody gets up and says, gee, we really ought to do something about producing a non-polluting power plant, when probably all the government would have to do is look to Detroit and say, look, on this kind of an engine, don't worry about the Antitrust Act. We'll let you work together. Or if you want to, go ahead and compete. We'll give you fast tax write-offs. By God, we'll see to it that even if you do have to invest $1 billion in retooling, that your investors are going to be protected. As a matter of fact, we'll see to it that they get a higher dividend than they get now. And brother, would you see some rapid action? Why don't we do it? I think it's because people in government just plain don't understand what they're supposed to do. So I would say that somebody has got to assume responsibility for obtaining these goals, which I hope our national academies will produce, and then develop the strategies and the tactics which are needed and the skills for using our free enterprise system properly. And if we can do that, believe me, city planning, urban planning, hospital systems, extended care units, all of us would miraculously be advanced. Now, I've carefully refrained from saying what our universities ought to do, because I feel a little bit vulnerable on this score, and I really haven't quite thought this through yet. Lots of things occur to me, but no matter what idea I come up with, I always end up with the fact that, gee whiz, universities are sacrosanct. You can't tell people at universities what they ought to do. You can only persuade them. You must somehow preserve the thing that makes a university strong. You want to use what is available at universities, but you don't want to destroy its texture. And let me tell you, this is an interesting problem all by itself. I will just tell you about one thing which is going on at my university now to give you an indication of how we think we might just creep up on this. Very recently at Penn, we have formed a center called the Center for Urban Research and Experiment. The name was picked, obviously, because the first letters spell CURE. CURE has a couple of missions and goals in life, the most important one of which will be to make it so darn attractive for people and professors and students in various disciplines to conglomerate and to work together that everyone will be eager to interact. So that really the basic objective of CURE will be to attract people by making it attractive for them. There are many ways in which it can be done. I don't want to take the time now to say it. We do feel that teaching people how to plan and analyze is not enough. Somehow we have got to take our graduate students, and this will be strictly a graduate program. I think it's nonsensical to get undergraduates involved. I think before a professional can really make a contribution in an interdisciplinary field, he better have a good, strong professional education behind him before he even starts. But what we are going to do then is to try and generate projects which, by the very nature of a beast, will involve just about every existing school at the university. Now, we want to see a payoff at the end of these projects. And, you know, when you try and accomplish something definite, when you want a product coming out, a great deal of what has to be done simply isn't appropriate to universities. So one thing which I'm going to try very hard to do is to establish sort of a tripartite organization between government, private industry, and the university. And by doing that, you see, all these things which are not appropriate for universities can be done by private industry. Those things which require original, creative thinking without being directed can be done very nicely at the university. And that way, I hope that we can start producing a crop of people who will be more effective in this arena of implementation than the planners we have produced today. Well, I think I have taken up enough of your time. Thank you very much, and I hope we will have a good discussion afterwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've had a most interesting and stimulating morning so far. I hope that these brief talks have generated some questions from the floor. We'll be happy to entertain them. There are fixed microphones at stations one on the side, two in the center, and three over at my right here. And if you try to make your way over to these microphones in order to direct your questions to any or all of the speakers, we'll be happy to entertain them for the remaining 15 minutes. I see we have some lovely young ladies to help out here. Very good.
This question is directed to Leland Johnson. In my analysis of what broadcasters spend on their work, I find that their expenditures on transmission are something like 8% of their budget, and the other 92% is spent on programming. And I was just wondering if perhaps there could be some expansion on the rationalization of how the transmission expenditures are an impediment when such high expenditures are on programming.
Yes, that is a very good point. One of the unfortunate aspects of the programming system, however, is that that with the impediment of the transmission, even though that is a low part of total cost, programming is not provided on a substantially repeat basis. That is, a network will have a schedule of shows. They'll be videotaped and then stored in the library, but they will be transmitted only once. What you could visualize in the more distant future is a nationwide system of satellite long-distance links going into rather small ground stations, which in turn would be tied into cable systems. And here you could then have programming covering, say, 20 channels. In some cases, the source would be in New York. In other cases, some of the programming would be of a purely local nature. But as part of this process, it is not difficult to appreciate the importance of very low-cost, long-distance transmission as one aspect of that. It is quite clear, it's quite true, that programming today is the largest part of total cost. In the same way that in the telephone industry, the local distribution facilities, the telephone instrument, the switching and such, are together the largest part of total cost. But this does not mean that reductions in long-distance transmission technology will have little impact, either on telephone rates for long-distance service or on the development of the future development of a nationwide expanded television industry. Again, very much depends on the issues of public policy, questions of regulation, the question of who owns what and under what conditions.
For Dr. Johnson, could you tell us why a task force was formed, President's Task Force on Communications was formed, and could you follow that by telling us whether there is a report or will be a report? Also, I have one other question. You did not touch in your talk on any aspect of a computer utility or anything on this inquiry which the FCC initiated regarding computer services. And I would appreciate some comments about that, if you can spare us a few.
Well, just very briefly, with respect to each of the three questions, the task force was formed because it became apparent to a large number of people a couple of years ago that public policy in this field is being formulated on a piecemeal basis, on a piecemeal ad hoc basis, where one faces a crisis and attempts to find a solution, whether it's with respect to spectrum management or with respect to decisions about a domestic satellite system or cable television or the international telecommunications industry. And so with the large number of crises situations over the past decades, and largely as a consequence of technological advance which strains the fabric of the institutional arrangements for regulation and control, it was decided that a broad-ranging study dealing with a number of issues would be advisable. And as it turned out, there were roughly eight major subjects that the task force treated. With respect to the second question, the report has not been publicly released. By this time, of course, all of the work has been completed. The staff backup materials are all complete. We had a number of contractor reports, which are now being made widely available. But the report itself, the task force report, is still being held in Washington. And the reason for this is that the new administration wants to carefully review it for its implications with respect to new legislation, with respect to possibilities of reorganization of government agencies and other things before it is made public. Now, no one can safely predict what will happen, but I am personally confident, reasonably confident, that the report will be made public in the near future. There have been innumerable requests from all kinds of groups for copies, and I certainly hope that it will be released soon. Now, very briefly, with respect to your third question, this raises a whole set of issues which together would could take the form of a 20-minute presentation. The computer inquiry is, of course, important. We looked at the computer industry to some extent within the limitations of time in the task force. One of the problems in the computer industry is that while the possibilities of national utilities may look good, We have to consider the fact that computer technology itself is advancing rapidly, so that small-scale computers are much more attractive now than they were 10 years ago. That is, at one point in time, you might consider that if you could tie together San Francisco and Los Angeles for computer purposes, this might look very attractive. But then 5 years later, we find that computers themselves can be made much smaller and much less expensively, so that an individual business employing its own computer seems like a more economic proposition than before. In other words, it's not just a case of reductions in long-distance transmission cost in looking at computer utilities. It is also looking at the improvements in the terminals themselves. And there's a kind of a race going on. On one hand, we see the reductions in costs for long-distance service. On the other hand, we see the increasing feasibility of small computers, which can be employed on a dedicated basis by companies which are much smaller than one would have thought feasible 5 or 10 years ago.
All right, we'll take the question first at station number 2. Right. Yes, sir.
Elaborate your statement that there were certain crude reforms you felt could be introduced into legislation. I happen to be from Canada. We've got a similar problem. We're fortunately a little bit behind. Have an opportunity to see what you might do, but we'd be interested in knowing something of the crude reform aspect, because I think, as some of the other speakers expressed, it's a massive problem, and if something's going to be done in time, perhaps some crude reforms might be the answer.
Yes, well, I speak entirely in terms of my own personal views on this, but one thing we see today is the block system of spectrum allocations. That is, taxi companies have certain channels which are used for that purpose, and these channels are the same in New York City in number as they are in Dodge City, Kansas. So this means that taxi companies in New York are badly pressed for capacity in a way that taxi companies in southwestern Kansas are not. Now, one of the more obvious fixes to this is to abolish that very rigid block system, where you have particular kinds of users who may use particular portions of spectrum space, and quite irrespective of the particular demands in that region for those particular services. We have moved a little ways in this direction. That is, today we are able in New York City, but only recently, to use channels which were previously allocated to forestry services. We can go much farther in this direction, and I hope within the next few years we'll see a much more flexible system. Now, this will require some equipment design and redesign. It will require transmitters with a tuning capability in some cases, or at least operating on different frequencies, which will require some hardware modifications. But I would consider that of second-order importance. The critical thing is to move away from the philosophy of these exclusive bands dedicated to particular narrow uses, irrespective of particular demands in regions of the country.
Sir?
This morning's session certainly left the impression that system technology that seems so extremely useful and really needed is not capable of solving so many of the problems that we have. Now, I would like to ask Mr. Eichmann and Mr. Baker to say if it would help if the professional societies, for instance, the IEEE and maybe a professional society that builds supersonic airplanes, if it would be possible to have them get on record that they think that this rapid advance of their technologies should be held down, and if it wouldn't be possible that they kind of discourage somewhat this drift into these technologies until some of the other systems have been solved.
Anybody want to be first?
I'll have a crack at what you have said. I think that with what we have learned in optimizing systems, every one of these tools and techniques, and this ranges from linear programming to dynamic programming to all kinds of optimization techniques, are tremendously useful once a problem has been put into form and language in which we can use these techniques. Unfortunately, our skills in formulating problems, in setting goals, and in defining trade-offs simply hasn't kept pace with what technology can do. The problem is one of developing a philosophy. Let me give you a simple example. We have an excellent group in our medical school at Penn, which has been studying the effects of air pollution on deaths. They have made a multiple regression analysis, and again, this is strictly statistics, and but it's backed up by some phenomenological tests. They have picked something